This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this latest in our series of curators' talks. I'm Michael Parker with the Friends Management Committee, and it's my pleasure today to welcome Jennifer Wilson, who's a curator in the gallery development team at the museum here. Jennifer joined the museum in 2005, but prior to that, she was curator of the Australian Stockman's Hall of Fame and the Qantas Founders Museum in Longreach. And since joining the museum, she's worked in a number of projects and areas, including the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander program, the new Australian Journeys and Creating a Country Galleries, and the Circa refurbishment. Today, Jennifer's going to be talking about Robe, the township, and many aspects of that. So thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Michael, and welcome everyone today on this lovely day. Basically, Robe is not famous for robes. I don't know if anyone's seen the ad, but I decided to steal that because I'll be telling you today a little of what Robe is actually famous for. Oh, we've got a few late arrivals. Okay. In November 1880, Mrs. Annie Banks, a resident in the town of Robe, wrote to the very Reverend Mother Mary MacKillop. Her words were heartfelt and sincere. "I hope you will be able to send us sisters soon, as we have every chance of a good school. So many are ready to take their children from the government school, as they have not been getting on well." In December, Annie wrote to Mary MacKillop again, pleading for sisters to reopen the Robe St. Joseph's School. "I hope you have not forgotten your promise to send us sisters, as they are so much wanted. I have been anxiously looking for a letter saying that they are coming, as the little ones will be lost if you do not take pity on us." These two letters, especially the first one, present some of the issues surrounding religion, education, and the politics of choice common to towns throughout South Australia during the late 19th century. The story of schools in the town of Robe has been selected for an exhibit in the new Creating a Country Gallery as part of the theme Land of Opportunity. Three places will be examined through this theme as locations in which Australians have endeavoured to create a just society where all citizens enjoy equality of opportunity and the ability to participate in shaping their society. Robe is the first place, the Melbourne suburb of Sunshine the second, and Old Parliament House in Canberra the third. These exhibits will encompass a variety of individual responses to place, different modes of participation, and diverse views about equality in the light of community expectations and centralised decision making. Robe is a town, which is on this map, which is a little bit hard to see. It's a town, fishing port and popular holiday destination in Geeshan Bay on the limestone coast of South Australia, with a district population of about 1,400. Robe is the main town of the District Council of Robe local government area, located within the state electorate of MacKillop. The county of Robe was proclaimed in 1846. Robe, as it appears today, developed as several distinct townships, sometimes known as suburbs. The government town of Robe comprised 126 allotments, with the town beach of Geeshan Bay as its northern border and Lake Butler to the west. The suburbs were Lordston, Honeyton or Honeytown, Sylam, East Robe and Newtown. Robe was South Australia's third port, and by the mid-1850s had become the second largest export port. The port, harbour and jetties quickly became dominated by local businesses, with imports and exports being managed by the South Australian government. During the 1850s and 1860s, as a thriving port, Robe was home to many different faiths and backgrounds. With population of around 400 to 500 persons, Robe boasted amenities not found in most regional centres. Churches of several different denominations, a government resident, a courthouse, a customs house, telegraph station, police station, barracks, jail, and several hotels. A colourful period in Robe's history occurred in the late 1850s and 1860s, when Robe experienced an increase in population, with more than 16,500 Chinese migrants passing through town on their way to the Victorian goldfields. Victoria Street, the main thoroughfare, was originally a bullock track, and as you can see, the Royal Circus, the roundabout at the end of Victoria Street, met the requirements of a bullock team to turn and deliver their loads to the port via the customs house. It's a pretty big turning circle. This is the customs house as it appears today, now preserved by the National Trust, as it, like many buildings, crumble. This is the seawall and the jetty, which is kind of sinking into the sea now, as they appear today. This is the waterfront, the main frontage of the town. These trees were planted by children of the school in 1954, and they are now a feature of the school, feature of the town, and also protected under National Trust listing. And there's another view of the coast. Robe declined as a port of importance during the latter decades of the 19th century. In 1870, intercolonial exports leaving Robe exceeded £95,000 in value. By 1879, its export value had decreased to only £16,000. The bullock teams were being outmaneuvered by the railways, which bypassed Robe. The jetties and harbour system were also never sufficient, being poorly engineered. It is due to these factors, despite some developments during the 20th century, that the structure of Robe Town now remains largely as it was in the 1870s. While attractive for many reasons, this coastline proved dangerous to shipping, with 14 shipwrecks recorded during Robe's first 15 years. And this shows you the locations of 8 of those shipwrecks. An obelisk was constructed of limestone on the Cape in 1855, as a government project to help guide ships safely to the port during the day. It was painted with red and white bands at the request of mariners in 1862 so that it could be more easily distinguished from the limestone cliff on which it stands. A lighthouse was not constructed at Robe until 1972, when the Kingston Lighthouse ceased operating. And that's the new completely automatic lighthouse. The obelisk is a key feature of the town's proud shipping heritage. There is a small souvenir obelisk on display today. It appears as Robe's emblem used for local government, various organisations and tourism promotion, and it is part of the symbolism of Robe Primary School. It is seen here on the school banner to be loaned for the exhibition and also the school emblem. The two main coastal bays of the district are also incorporated into the school's symbolism. Lacepede and Geishan have been adopted as the names of the school's sporting houses, and these banners will also be loaned. One ship of great interest to the Creating a Country exhibit is that of the Koning Wilhelm II. The 800-tonne Dutch vessel had completed unloading 397 Chinese passengers and cargo on the 25th of June, 1857. Because of bad weather, the Koning Wilhelm remained in anchor in Geishan Bay until the 30th of June, when it was ripped from its mooring lines by strong winds. The captain set sail in an effort to safely beach the vessel, but after a successful grounding just off Long Beach, large seas continued to sweep over the ship, making it a total wreck. Only 9 crewmen made it safely to shore, thanks largely to the effort of locals. The other 15 crewmen either died on the vessel or drowned while trying to swim to the beach. The remains of Koning Wilhelm were sold to Mr. Jacob Chambers of Robe, who dismantled the wreck for various purposes in town. Known remains of the wreck are 2 cannons, one which sits here on Flagstaff Hill in the Royal Circus, and some of the ship's doors and its timbers were used in the construction of the Caledonian Inn, which was then being built under the ownership of Scotsman Peter McQueen. 2 other pieces of the wreck which survived were the ship's bells, which have been used at Robe Primary School for as long as anyone can remember. These school bells are a nice segue from shipwrecks back to matters of education. Educational institutions in Australia were founded on the principles of the English education system, but differed or evolved from that model due to the social, geographic, and economic situations in which the colonists found themselves. During the first decades of settlement, education was largely viewed as an opportunity afforded to the wealthy, with schools for the poor and lower classes considered an act of charity and the work of religious groups, as they had been in England. From the 1850s to the end of the 19th century, the Australian colonies set about restructuring and standardising schools and their educational programs. There was increasingly community encouragement, not simply for government financial support, but the government's direct provision of schools and education. The South Australian government, after a series of acts, implemented a program which would support education, but only in those schools which itself operated or which met strict conditions. South Australia became the first colony to remove government financial support for denominational schools and religious instruction from the classroom. These actions, the government hoped, would centralise and standardise the training of teachers, curriculum, the construction of school buildings, and offer universal education to all children throughout the colony. The question of the provision of education would become one of the key debates in the colony, causing religious denominations to split into factions and the division between the church and the state to widen. Interestingly, the town of Robe is named after Governor Frederick Holt Robe, seen here, very charming looking man, who was one of the instigators of this debate. The first South Australian Education Act was introduced in 1847 by Governor Robe. The 1847 Act proclaimed a system of grant funding to the various religious denominations for their churches and schools to be administered by a Board of Education. This was Governor Robe's attempt to make ends meet in a colony rife with debt. To appease the denominations that opposed the legislation, Governor Robe introduced subsequent ordinances to organise the distribution of the grants and to separate aid for religion from aid for education. But the conflict had been established and would continue. South Australia was founded with liberal ideals, which were resistant to any dominance or authority of one religious group over another. During the 1850s, many people embraced the idea of universal education with a reforming attitude. Growing poverty and crime rates were viewed as products of each other. The implementation of a government-funded and administered standardised system of education offered occasion to use education as a tool for moral and social benefit and to create a form of equality. An article printed in the Register of March 1850 summarised some of this general attitude. Intellect is not a matter of inheritance. The cottager is endowed by nature with capacities equal to the peer. Turn them both to the plough, and they will be nothing else but ploughmen to the end of their days. But open the book of knowledge to them, give them a fair start in the race, and the chances will be equal for the prize. The religious denominations of the colony maintained a desire to educate the children in their own congregations. The population of South Australia continued to practice the religion of their choice, but the government pushed for the creation of a centralised education system which would offer a secular education to all children in the colony, regardless of their religious backgrounds. The very fact that the colony of South Australia had been founded on the principles of religious freedom and equality meant that no one denominational education system could be favoured, and that division along sectarian lines would continue. In South Australia, the Church of England had inferior position and numbers. The Church of England supported the centralisation of education and the government's provision of that education, but continued to object to the complete removal of the Bible from the classroom. Rather than establishing dominance in elementary education, the Anglicans focused their effort on creating prestigious secondary colleges aimed at the colonial elite. The Wesleyan Methodist Church did have the numbers in South Australia to influence politics. Methodist leaders encouraged their members to take an interest in politics and to vote to ensure their rights were heard. They did not trust the government involvement in funding or involvement in or funding of religious organisations following their persecutions in England. Methodist support for universal education came from a desire for social reform, especially against drinking and gambling. While the Methodists opposed the removal of religion from the classroom, their strong anti-Catholic sentiments overruled their objections to the government system. The Methodists chose instead to strengthen their Sunday schools. The Lutherans too established their own schools and educational systems, and they opposed the government intervention. The Lutherans established schools in their own townships, dedicated to espousing their religious faith and continuing instruction in the German language. The Lutherans' community ability to maintain those ideals was gradually challenged by an increasingly diverse population in South Australia and the pressures of standardisation. The Catholics did not have a large population in South Australia, and they were considered to be very poor. The Catholics saw themselves greatly disadvantaged by the removal of government funding for their schools and raised the strongest objections to the government education system. And I'll talk more about the resulting Catholic education system in a moment. At greatest disadvantage under any of the education systems were the isolated poor in rural areas. Despite the fact that much of South Australia's population in the 1850s was rural, the distances between places, the lack of resources and funding, and the fact that education was not necessarily a priority for all, country schools remained poorly funded and understaffed. The history of schools in Robe is intertwined with the histories of the churches in the town. If for no other reason, then the church buildings were some of the first permanent stone structures in the district. As in other towns throughout South Australia, many of the first schools in Robe were established by the various denominations in residence. Before the construction of church buildings, it seemed that many of the denominations in Robe shared what space was available. And when schools were established in the churches, they were not exclusive to the members of their congregations. It was stated in the register of January 4, 1859, that different denominations in Robe Town and the Geechan Bay District generally are exceedingly liberal and tolerant in their religious opinions toward one another. This opinion is to some degree supported in the histories of local churches and school, though any denominational cooperation may have been the result of a lack of funds and population rather than a realisation of any ideals for community cohesion. There is some debate about which was the first church completed and opened in Robe. What does seem certain is that both the Free Presbyterian Chapel and the Catholic Church were completed in December 1858. The Free Presbyterian Chapel, which appears here, still stands adjacent to St Peter's Church of England today, which was built in 1859. Despite its modest size, the chapel had many lives. It was used by all the Protestant denominations in Robe before other churches were built, obviously one at a time. The Free Presbyterian Chapel was used to house the Mechanics Institute from 1862 to 1868 when it was relocated to a new building. In both locations, the Institute was a hub of local activity, with meetings of organisations held, a library collected, and the lectures and social gatherings hosted there. The chapel was the site of meetings of the Robe Temperance Society from July 1862, and it became a museum in 1865. A school was opened in the chapel in 1869 by Reverend Howitt. In later years, it was used as the Anglican Sunday school room, as it is to this day. In 1858, the building of a Catholic church in Robe was commissioned by the Reverend Julian Tennyson Woods, priest of the parish of Penola. Along with the churches at Morfett Vale and Penola, St Mary's Star of the Sea is one of the three oldest Catholic churches in South Australia, and one of the few with a chimney and a fireplace. The building was made of local limestone, quarried from Richmond Park, and has many of its original features still intact. Julian Tennyson Woods, religious leader and educator, became priest in charge of the parish of Penola in 1857. He landed in Robe, then the chief seaport of the district, when travelling to Penola to take up his new position. Woods rested for a couple of days in Robe and found about a dozen Catholics, of whom only one was a householder and the rest were servants. Indeed, the poverty of the local community at that time, especially the small Catholic population, is noted by Woods and a number of other sources. During his time as priest of the district, Woods visited Robe approximately every 3 months. It would seem that he was well regarded by most people in the area, becoming friends with many landowners and townspeople, both Catholic and non-Catholic. Woods supported not only the religious interests of the district, but also its civic, economic, and academic pursuits. Woods sent botanical and fossil specimens that he collected during his travels to distant scholars, scientists, museums, and herbariums, including Baron Ferdinand von Mueller at the Melbourne Botanical Gardens. Woods was also an eager supporter of the mechanics institutes throughout the region, including Robe, recognising their importance for community education and cohesion. He would have viewed them as useful places to discuss his research and ideas. Woods gave several lectures at the Robe Institute, including the one cover of which is shown here, Not Quite as Old as the Hills, on the Evidences of Man's Antiquity, which is a response to Darwin. And the first reading of his autobiographical account of his time in the Panola District, 10 Years in the Bush. In 1862, Woods published his first scientific work, Geological Observations of South Australia. There's a copy on display here today. This copy was owned by John Baptist Austin, mine agent and broker, who published his own work, The Mines of South Australia, in 1863. In this book, Woods states, Robe Town, though situated in a most dreary bed of sandhills, has a cheerful and picturesque appearance. It lies on a limestone tertiary formation, which supplies a pure white and durable stone for its buildings. Woods was criticised by his contemporaries for spending too much time on scientific endeavour, but Woods maintained that God and his religious work always came first. Woods had been appointed priest of the Panola district at an interesting time. As the debate over secular education raged, Adelaide Bishop Gagan declared, "We Catholics must have separate schools or none at all, aided by the state." Despite the poverty in which the congregation lived, Bishop Gagan encouraged Catholics of the colony to establish schools in their community, regardless of the cost. A young and enthusiastic Julian Tennyson Woods was keen to act upon the bishop's direction. In 1861, Woods met Mary MacKillop, then 19 years old. Mary was working as a governess on her uncle's property at Panola. Mary heard Woods speak of the neglected state of the children in the parish and offered to support his idea for establishing a school where education was free to all children. After much discussion and correspondence, Woods and MacKillop founded a new religious order of nuns who would reach out and spread across regional Australia. Their first school was held in a stable in Panola, but within 1 year they had raised the funds and built a permanent stone structure which still stands in Panola today. The Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart was the first Catholic order to be founded in Australia. According to the wishes of its founders, Woods and MacKillop, the order was to be dedicated to the education of poor children throughout regional Australia. Within its first decade, the Sisters of St. Joseph had enlarged their membership and mission to include more than 30 schools and an orphanage. The Sisters of St. Joseph were characterised by their vow of poverty, having few possessions of their own, and what they did have represented their faith and work as part of the Catholic Church. A St. Joseph's school was established in the Robe Catholic Church in 1869. A room was added to the back of the church to act as the convent, with accommodation for two sisters at a time. It's not very big or comfortable, but anyway. Mary MacKillop was in Robe to establish the school and make sure the sisters were settled. The sisters who served in Robe were amongst the first postulants in the new order and some of her closest friends. She kept regular contact with the sisters, acting in a general administration role. In 1870, Sister Calisanctus wrote to Mary MacKillop, "We are very happy here, Sister Michael and I, in our quiet little convent, unworthy of me to be so happy." In Robe, as elsewhere, the sisters operated under the strict rules of their order. The Sisters of St. Joseph became known as the Josephites or Brown Joeys amongst their communities. The nickname Brown Joeys referred to their distinctive brown habits, a mark of the poverty of their order. In establishing the rules for the order, Woods and MacKillop recorded in detail the components of the sisters' dress as part of their daily ritual. In their words, the sisters were to wear a brown woolen dress gathered at the waist by a leather girdle, from which shall hang a strong chaplet of wood or bone beads joined with iron wire and terminated by a small cross. They shall wear a small crucifix in their belt. The final component of the habit was to be a large blue monogram of the Blessed Virgin, an A and an M, between three letters, J, in honour of Jesus, St. Joseph and St. John the Baptist, thus typifying the Holy Family. This monogram, which actually looks like a lot like the ABC symbol, does predate it, was made of plain blue woolen braid and was worn on the breast of the habit. This arrangement is clearly visible in the 19th century photographs of the sisters. The rules also established what was to be taught in the St. Joseph's schools. According to the customs of the order, the sisters of St. Joseph travelled, worked and lived in twos, so two sisters would have taught at any one time in robe. According to the rules, the sisters' daily routine began at 5 a.m, with every hour accounted for until they retired at 10 p.m. Teaching would have been only a small part of that routine, as they were expected to maintain regular prayers and mass, clean, prepare meals for the children, prepare their classes, accompany the children home after school, and visit local families and sick children. For all these activities, the sisters relied on the charity of their community to support them. The Hudson and Rhine families in Robe, for example, supplied the sisters with meat and milk free of charge. Because the sisters of St. Joseph took a vow of poverty, few material possessions remain for any type of exhibition. It is the letters between Mary MacKillop and the sisters which tell us most of what we know about the early schools. This is the interior of the Robe Church. Quite simple. It's been renovated a number of times. In Robe, class was held in the main body of the church. The names of four students who attended the Robe St. Joseph's School are shown on a small plaque in the back pew of the church. The Sisters of St. Joseph met with a number of difficulties during the first two decades of operation, including opposition from members of the Catholic Church, especially the hierarchy, and financial and geographical circumstances. Despite community support for the Josephites, the inability of Woods to gain support for the ideals of the system led to its partial failure. On the 22nd of September 1871, Mary MacKillop and 47 of the sisters were excommunicated from Adelaide by Bishop Scheele. The sisters were reinstated quickly on the 23rd of February 1872, but during the following years, the Institute of the Sisters of St. Joseph was brought under direct control and Wood's involvement ended. During the period of the sisters' excommunication, the Robe School was closed for less than 6 months. Reverend Michael O'Connor, then in charge of the parish of Panola, had been unsupportive of the work of the Sisters of St. Joseph for a number of years. The sisters were quickly reinstated in Robe at the insistence of Father van der Heijden, who took charge of the district in January 1872. And we can see a letter from Sister Michael in 1872 to Julian Tennyson Woods that comments on her return to Robe. "I suppose you will be surprised to hear that I am back in Robe. Sister Veronica is here with me. The people here are more than delighted to get the sisters back, and I don't know what they are not threatening to do if anyone will even think of taking the sisters away again for the next 10 years. For the next 7 years, activities were fairly normal at the school." Letters from Sister Gaetano to Mary MacKillop are simple, covering daily happenings in Robe. In 1878, she asked for brown cloth and white cotton to make scapulars for the children and permission for her and Sister Joseph to bathe in their old habits at the Robe Beach. That would have been very uncomfortable. In 1879, Sister Gaetano comments on the continued poverty amongst the small Catholic community of the town. "There being so few Catholic children here that even though most of all of them gave a shilling each, it still does not come to a pound. We have put a few shillings in with it ourselves to make the ten." From its beginnings in South Australia, the Sisters of St. Joseph expanded to Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, Western Australia, the Northern Territory, New Zealand, Peru, and Ireland. It was partially due to that rapid expansion and the small number of students in Robe that the St. Joseph's School closed in 1880. A letter from Sister Gaetano, then in Cadena, to Mary MacKillop on the 20th of April 1880 provides reference to the closure of the Robe School. Then the letters from Annie Tanks in the late 1880s seeking the return of the sisters confirms the end of the Robe School. Annie's letter also tells us that things are not going well at the department school. So what was wrong with the government school? In 1880, the government school was housed in the Bible Christian Chapel, the fourth church built in Robe. The Education Department purchased the building in 1875, creating the 10th school in town. The establishment of this new school was directly related to events in Adelaide. In 1875, the South Australian Government introduced a new Education Act. Its intention was to make education compulsory for children between the ages of 7 to 14. Full-time attendance was not necessary, with two-thirds of the year being a minimum, to allow for the continued need for children's labour on family farms. The Act insisted that no sectarian or denominational religious teaching should be allowed in any school. The government's mandate for its education system, free, compulsory, and secular, was thereby complete, although the free part wouldn't actually be a reality until 1893. The architect of the new system was John Anderson Hartley, shown here in the centre, sitting on the little table, with other leaders of education at the University of Adelaide in 1891. Hartley graduated from the University of London with Bachelors of Arts and Science in 1870. He arrived in Adelaide in January 1871 to take up his appointment as headmaster of Prince Alfred College. In May 1871, Hartley was appointed to the Central Board of Education, and in March 1874 was elected as chairman. Hartley was a devout Methodist, and so his approach seemed to appeal at least to that sector of the community. In 1885, Hartley founded the Education Gazette to carry his ideas to teachers, being its editor until 1896. He developed and prepared arithmetic books and teachers' manuals, produced primers and reading charts, designed copybooks, and in 1889 founded the Children's Hour, and in 1891 the Adelaide Poetry Book, as supplementary reading for children. Hartley was also a founder of the University of Adelaide, viewing it as a desirable training ground for better teachers. So he kind of controlled everything. Under the 1875 Act, it was the responsibility of local community councils and organisations to seek the provision of schools in their districts. Funding, teachers and resources were allocated by the Education Department according to student enrolment and performances. Not much has changed. Section 8 of the Education Act stated, "Public schools will be established in any locality where the council are satisfied that there are at least 20 children who will attend the school, and as soon as a suitable building can be obtained and the council are able to appoint a teacher." Pupil teachers, or teaching assistants, were appointed to a school after student attendance reached 45 and a further teacher after 75. To exercise supervision over educational affairs in each district, communities appointed a local board of advice. The local boards of advice then elected a chairman who was responsible for all correspondence with the Education Department. The nature of that correspondence was to include reports if the regulations were not faithfully carried out, reports if school records were not accurately kept, or property not taken care of, consider applications for free education, and to report on complaints against teachers. And so, a local board of advice was founded in Robe, which began to meet in the Robe Institute building, a centre for education in the Robe community. And there's another lengthy talk I could give about the history of institutes in Robe and South Australia, but for the moment I will say that the Institute building to this day houses the local library, which is used as the school library, and is the venue for the school's annual concert. The local board of advice maintained correspondence, as directed, with the government department in Adelaide, making requests for building maintenance, supplies and school holidays each year. This book records correspondence from Robe to Adelaide between 1878 and 1900. The Robe local board of advice met at the Institute in November 1878, then with Francis Daniel Hodge, the local bank manager, as chairman. The local board of advice endorsed the compulsory clauses of the 1875 Education Act, believing them to be beneficial to the community. And this is the school and children in 1878. Complaints were regularly made about the Bible Christian Chapel building. Despite some improvements, it was never appropriate as a school. In 1881, the local board of advice wrote to the Minister of Education complaining that the windows cannot be made watertight and the stained glass in different colours is very trying for the children's eyes when they're writing because of the reflection coming onto the desks. Problems at the school had increased following the closure of the Catholic St. Joseph's School. many of those students began attending the government school, thereby increasing attendance without adequate furnishings to cope. Further desks and seating were requested, but it was clear that a new building was required. And so you can see what was included in the school at the time. I'm not sure how useful a map of Great Britain was, but it's okay. they did order a map of South Australia in about 1900, so caught up eventually. Chief Inspector of Schools, John Hartley, recommended the building of a new school in Robe in May 1884, but this announcement only came after local petitions. The land for the new school had been reserved in 1880, but the department was slow to act. In January 1884, an interesting comment appeared in the Border Watch. It suggests that Mr. Parsons, then Minister for Education, did not announce his visit to the town to avoid local protesters. After numerous letters, local meetings, and a petition sent to Parliament, work on a new school building was begun in January 1885 and completed by December 1885. The new school opened for business in 1886, and this photo commemorates that event. Newly arrived head teacher Thomas Moore described the school to a friend in 1901. "The school is situated at the foot of a nicely wooded hill, and the grounds are the best kept that I have seen. The school contains two large rooms, well lighted. The house has five rooms. The pupils are a splendid class of youngsters and are easily taught." That was the beginning of the year. I'm not sure if he had the same opinion at the end. This is a photo of Mr. Moore, who's sort of smudged out to the right of the picture, and then students in 1902 or 1903, not sure, but yeah, lively little bunch. So just to give you a bit of an idea, just going through some photos, class photos over the years, the school building changes in shape and style, and of course the body of school students changes over the years. The school pipe band was a pretty big feature for many years. And by 1985 we have uniforms, and the building of course has to keep expanding to deal with ever-increasing student numbers. This is the school as it appears today. It's due to, of course, celebrate its 125th anniversary next year. This is the Oval, which used to be the showgrounds as well. So the original building is to the left of that picture, and some of the new buildings are to the right. And this is the entrance now, which looks a little bit more developed than the 1885 picture. So to return to 1878, let's meet a few of the students and teachers from across the generations. The female assistant teacher in this photo, and she's just standing in the lovely black dress on the left of the photo, is Miss Elsie McQueen. Elsie's father, Scotsman Peter McQueen, was the owner of the Caledonian Inn. During the early 1870s, Elsie operated a small school from this building, which was known as the school in Rotten Row. Don't think it's that rotten, but... In 1875, Miss Elsie McQueen presented this book to Alice Dawson as a second prize for general proficiency. We do not know much about Alice's years at the Robes School, but several of her prize books have survived through the family generations, indicating that she was a well-behaved and intelligent student. According to the family, Alice finished her schooling in Adelaide to escape the interests of a young man. Scandalous. Alice eventually married George Birmingham, but as he was a Catholic and she Anglican, the couple had to get married in Narracourt to avoid local controversy. Alice's niece, Annie Dawson, lived at Dingleydell with her family. Named for Adam Lindsay Gordon's association with the property, on which he was a horsebreaker between 1861 and 1863, Dingleydell is a small building on the outskirts of Robe. Again, there's no time for a complete history of Adam Lindsay Gordon, but the short version is he was a good friend of Julian Tennyson Woods, and he met his wife, a young Scottish woman, at the Caledonian Inn, and his only daughter was born in Robe, though she didn't live for very long. Annie Dawson, her brothers and sisters all attended Robe Primary School, as had her father and many of his siblings. They walked or rode on horses or bikes the 4 kilometres to town from Dingleydell. This is a photo of young Annie and her daughter Helen in Annie's garden earlier this year, 1 month before Annie's 99th birthday. No doubt she'll make it past 100. As a girl, Annie also made the 4 kilometre trip into town each week to attend Sunday school at the Church of England. This was her Sunday school Bible presented to Annie in 1908. Annie now lives in a house opposite the Robe Primary School, which is where her daughter Helen grew up. So Helen didn't have to trek the 4 kilometres to school each day like her mum. She simply crossed the road. This was Helen's school dictionary. Helen has returned to Robe after decades of living elsewhere to look after her mum, and with her husband George is in the process of restoring Dingleydell, the former family home. Annie's brother, Victor Dawson, also attended Robe Primary School. His school exit certificate is on loan to the National Museum and is in the showcase today. As the certificate states, after completing the primary school course, Vic was qualified to enter upon a course of higher instruction. Vic pursued a number of different interests after leaving school, but his first work was on the Dingleydell property with his father. In 1938, Robert Dawson and his family generously provided land for the research purposes of CSIR, later CSIRO, for the Division of Animal Health and Nutrition. This research site played a crucial role in identifying the causes of coast disease in sheep. This wasting disease was caused by sheep grazing in paddocks of deficient in both copper and cobalt. The identification of this trace element deficiency has secured the development of large tracts of infertile land for agricultural production and improvements in livestock products. And this is a photo of young Vic, probably the year after he graduated, with his father and his aunt working at the research station. Because Annie lives opposite the school, most of the young female teachers boarded with her during their time in Robe Primary School. In 1950, Doris Francis travelled from Glasgow to Adelaide under the employment of the South Australian Education Department. This was the suitcase given to Doris by her students in Glasgow. Doris was a teacher at Robe Primary School from 1953 to 1955 when she married one of Annie's brothers and became a Dawson herself. And being married, she had to leave her teaching position. That legislation only ended in the late 70s, early 80s. Jenny, who was related to most of the core families in town, started as a student at the Robe Primary School in 1960. Hers was one of the first classes to receive formal uniforms, which of course incorporated the obelisk and its red and white colouring. She was also quite small. Robe Primary School has a complete record of Jenny's schooling, and we can see that through roll books, which will be borrowed, and also Jenny's report cards, which are quite funny, which she's also generally offered for loan. This is a photo of Jenny in her final year of school. She's up in the far right corner. And this is a photo of the staff of Robe Primary School today, of which Jenny is a member. She's been the student support officer there since 1997. She's in the back row in the red and black T-shirt. I'll conclude today with the words of John Goodchild. By right of historic fact, as well as by what has been handed down, Robe compels curiosity and handsomely rewards anyone thereby indulging. My research in Robe has been a rewarding experience, and I hope those who visit Creating a Country in 2011 will find the exhibition interesting. Thank you.
How did you come to choose Robe?
Good question. I actually just started basically with the idea of choosing any school in South Australia, which is a pretty broad idea. I was led to Robe just by reading general histories of education, both of primary schools, high schools and the institutes. So there's a lot of different levels of education which are involved in the story. Robe actually appeals because it's completely normal and very average. and it actually, I think, highlights probably the best of any that I could find about the relationship between what was happening in Adelaide, both for the Catholics and the state school system, as to how that actually affected a school in regional South Australia, which is very hard to sort of grasp on an object material culture level. I was led there mainly through both the religious story and the state school story. I found it interesting that after there being so many different schools in Robe, in 1880 there's that sharp cut where all of a sudden there's 10 different schools, but then there's one. and it's then the story really of how the community as a whole then decides to get behind that one school and make sure that their children get every opportunity that they can. As a regional school, of course, like most in Australia, it's put under constant pressure for closure during the 1950s and 60s. and so it's that ongoing sort of community support for the school, which is kind of endearing, really. You get the generational continuing story where we've got now great-grandparents actually taking their great-grandchildren for reading at the school. and that kind of thing is a really nice way to bring out what's a very complex political and social history.
You said there that some of the parents were complaining there was a problem in the state schools.
Yes.
What did they see as was the problem?
Well, there were numerous problems. It depended on what religion you were part of, and also the fact, I mean, the school had problems from an environmental concern, basically. Because it wasn't watertight at that time, they actually refused to send their children to school because Robe is really quite cold. it's very close to those Antarctic winds, which you can experience at this time of the year. And they weren't willing to send their children to the school for that reason. There were also some fairly dodgy teachers over the years who would hit children and yell at children, which is why most people preferred the Catholic school, because the nuns were much more gentle and caring in their attitudes. Not completely, but they were better than some of the state school teachers, who were mostly retired military personnel. So it kind of depended basically on what kind of education you wanted your children to have. Those who were completely against what was happening in Robe sent their children to Adelaide, but boarding was very expensive, as it is now, so that wasn't an option for everyone. So the pressure was really put on the state system to sort of pick up its act, basically, and provide what was needed for the community.
I've heard or read of the name Tennyson Woods prior to this talk, and I wondered if he was the only Tennyson Woods in Australia, or do you know of any others?
I don't know of any others. What was funny, actually, through my research, having a common name myself, was that actually a few years after Tennyson Woods leaves as a Catholic priest of the district, there's a Father Woods who arrives as Anglican priest in the district, but his name is not actually Tennyson Woods. I don't know of any others, but Julian Tennyson Woods is kind of a shadowy figure in a lot of ways. His name has certainly gotten around, but it's gotten around for so many different reasons that it's sometimes hard to pin down where you may have heard it or, you know, in what context. He goes on to found another religious order as well, a Catholic order of monks, so the male version of the Sisters of St. Joseph, basically. So he's fairly out there. He also conducts research in Japan and Southeast Asia from a geographical and botanical point of view. So he's around for a long time in a lot of different areas, but he's not the most famous. It's just one of those names, I guess, that comes up every now and again. And he's quite an interesting character.
You talked about the Institute, and I wondered, have you actually done any more research? Because my understanding has been that the Institute system was actually very, very important in South Australia, and in fact very important in terms of general education, the library became a focal point in Robe and in Kingston.
Yes, yeah. It's extremely important, and I would love to have spent more time on the Institute, but it hasn't been the main focus. There's been so much with the primary schools that the rest of the story it just gets huge. The Institute in Robe was extremely important, and it's actually noted fairly regularly in histories of institutes in South Australia because it was known to have one of the most extensive foreign libraries in the state. I think there's about 20 different types of newspapers that they get in regularly, and so many different books, most of which are donated by the local community. Julian Tennyson Woods sort of supplied a lot of his own material at certain times. They're a real focal point for so many things. It's really hard to pin down one thing that they did, but certainly there's regular meetings there, regular lectures. Julian Tennyson Woods is only one of them. Adam Lindsay Gordon certainly gave a few talks. And that's all advertised in the Border Watch newspaper, which is really the main source of information about what was happening. Those lectures are advertised months in advance, and everyone and sort of reports on what happened at the lecture afterwards. So there's a real sort of social sense of, you know, what was happening there was really important. The lecture that Woods gives in response to the Darwin theories of evolution is actually responded to again by a different scientist. And it's sort of interesting to watch. There's a couple of weeks worth of discussion about these two lectures in the newspaper, sort of. They're a bit torn because they're all such big Woods fans. They don't want to go against Woods, but they're also very taken with what was just said about evolution. So there's certainly a lot of public discussion. They're real centres of entertainment, of activity, especially in small communities. Again, it's just so important to have that, and it seems to appeal to all ages and all pursuits. So yeah, it's kind of a side story for me, but yeah, there's a lot there.
Thank you for your talk. I'm interested in where you found the correspondence with Mary MacKillop and the nuns.
Yes, well, thankfully, the Sisters of St. Joseph have been very helpful. The story of the letters are quite interesting. We won't actually be borrowing any of the originals because they're actually bound in several volumes. They were actually used as evidence for Mary's path to sainthood. Basically, when Mary died, most people had her on the path to sainthood immediately, but we all know it's not that simple. People were instructed at the time of her death to gather anything they could, letters, memories. People wrote down a lot of their memories and sent them in. People sent any objects that they had that Mary may have touched or used. And all of that was gathered together in Sydney it's still being gathered, basically, but over a particular five-year period just after her death in 1912. The letters are sort of vary. There's not really a rhyme or reason to why some of them may have been kept as opposed to others, but we're lucky that those that have survived do tell us something about the Robe story. The letters are basically a way of administrating the sisters. They request what they need, just like they do with the education department system as well. Clothing, supplies, everything, all the requests go to Mary MacKillop or one of her lieutenants to try and put that together that and respond and send out what's needed to the various districts. So at the very basics, they're just administration. On other levels, there's a lot of requests for prayer, some very sort of personal things from Mary that we're not actually able to publish. They're still quite protected of some of her personal views on things and some of her thoughts. She's a prolific letter writer and writes right up until the time she passes away to her various sisters and the communities. She's not able to travel for about the last two decades of life because she's quite ill, so she continues that correspondence to keep in touch. So it's a really lovely and quite eye-opening record, but they're all kind of kept quite, well, I wouldn't say secretively, but quite heavily guarded at the archives in Sydney. And there is public access to those archives, but mostly, if you're like me, you get access to the reproductions, and the rest of the collection is actually kept under lock and key, because, of course, they're quite fragile now. Mary MacKillop also wrote on both sides of paper, and it's actually really, really hard to read. So that was painstakingly transcribed back in the 30s, 40s and 50s by various archivists, and so the record we have now is actually the reproductions. But, yeah, there's so many letters there. Yeah, it's a really valuable resource. It's really mostly all that's left of the early years of the Institute.
Having grown up in post-World War II, New South Wales Department of Education, and then continuing into the department, I can remember being taught by married women way back in the 50s. Why was it then that was it political or economic in the South Australian system that married women did not take part in up until the 1970s?
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing, and I probably shouldn't have referred to it the way I did, because it was never a blanket rule, which is why I don't completely understand it. there are numerous married women who work in Robe and other schools at various times. I think Doris gets, the teacher with the suitcase, she gets married sort of earlier in the year, and she actually works the rest of the year as Doris Dawson, and then leaves school. I don't think it was always something that was forced upon the women necessarily, and I think some of the variations in who did leave and who didn't leave, or who was forced to leave and who wasn't, comes back to sort of the regional school as well, because it wasn't always easy to get regional teachers, or teachers going to regional schools. So some of those women were kept in their positions if possible. Certainly, even into the one of the teachers I talked to, she had to leave in the 1970s when she got married. But yeah, there doesn't seem to be necessarily a strict rule that governs it. It sort of seems to be a more case-by-case basis, and it mainly comes back to politics rather than economics. There's certainly a difference in how much women are paid as opposed to men. But I think it's more seen that, maybe it's social rather than political, that women should be at home, have children. you know, that angle sort of comes back into it. That's certainly in the parliamentary debates, that's the way it is. But in Robe, you know, it's a shame, because in the late 1800s, all the schools are run by women, like Elsie McQueen. They start up those schools off their own back, basically, with maybe a grant for a few pounds from the government. But all the schools, they pass through numerous women because each one sort of gets married, and then they have to pass it on to another unmarried woman who gets married a couple of years later, and then you've got another one. And, yeah, so it's a disruptive system, but it really does last for a long time that way. But, yeah, it seems to be case by case. That's right. And then it's up to the different states thereafter as to what they did when, sort of in changing those rules. So... Yep. Yes.
One last question. In that period around the 1880s and so on, was it compulsory to send your children to school, and was there a sort of a minimum standard that children were expected to attain?
Certainly was. It depended how closely the teachers were keeping their records. Inspectors would go to the schools at least once every year, and they would inspect class school books and all that kind of thing. I mean, it's still done today, but it was a little bit different then. And basically, the compulsory clauses come in 1875 with the Act, but they're not really able to enforce it because children are still required to work on family farms during harvest seasons and that kind of thing. So they go for quite a long time. They go to about two-thirds of the year, which is compulsory, so the roll books are kept to make sure that children are attending enough. The main problem is that the system is not free until 1893, so it's really hard for a lot of people to afford it, and certainly Robe is not really a wealthy community, sort of especially past the 1870s, when sort of shipping declines and not as much is coming through town. A lot of people leave, or they exist on a fairly meagre amount of money. So there's not a lot of money to send kids to school. What the local board of advice has to do is actually take applications for free education at that time. So parents apply to the local board of advice, who then send that application to the minister for his sign-off to be able to attend free of charge. So the education department picks up that bill. And that's there's numerous reasons in the correspondence listed. On one occasion, the father is injured and so can't work for a few months. So those children have permission to go to school, and then the government picks up the tab. So that's kind of how the system works, to try and get as many children as possible to attend for the compulsory two-thirds of the year. But as far as I can tell, it's not a perfect system. And when it comes to actually assessment and recording the grades of children and all of that, there seems to be a little bit of leverage for teachers to perhaps kind of interpret who's okay and who's not. So I guess the further away from Adelaide you are, maybe the more leverage you have. But it's not really a perfect system until sort of into the first decades of the 1900s, when it becomes sort of more regulated, the system's free, there's a better, the local boards of advice are cut out of the picture, and the department has the staff to administer more of it themselves. So yeah, there's a few changes there.
Thanks again, Jennifer. If any more questions, Jennifer will be here for a little while longer. So thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.